All right, Matt, talked about a deceptively simple question, who am I? And I'm going to tackle another deceptively simple question, where am I? I mean, we all know we're here, I get that, and we have some sort of simple slogans that help us a bit. There's bloom where you're planted, right? That's probably a lot of truth to that, except some of us are planted in really toxic soil in which nothing can bloom, so that doesn't help us very much. And I'm really going to lean into thinking about where we are in terms of actually doing recovery ministry. Where are you trying to do recovery ministry rather than doing personal recovery? And I'm going to begin with a very a great oversimplification. I'm going to suggest that recovery ministry exists somewhere at the intersection between three distinct cultures in the U.S. at least. Therapeutic culture, Christian culture, and recovery culture. And the only excuse I can make for such a massive oversimplification is it turns out to be helpful. Right? It's simple enough that it gives you some handles to think about, well, where am I in relationship to these three cultures? Let me tell you in broad strokes what I mean by these three cultures. Therapeutic culture is anything where there are appointments, schedules, fee schedules, trained people doing things with untrained people. So this would be detox, treatment, counseling, therapy, whatever, all of that, whether paid for or not, that's all the stuff I think of as therapeutic culture. Recovery culture is going to be principally for this morning talking about 12-step culture in the U.S. I think it's long overdue for us to think of it as a distinct culture. It's not this sort of small movement. It's the largest explicitly spiritual social movement in American culture since the Second Great Awakening. It's a much bigger social movement than the Great Awakening was. I didn't get that for a long time. I think it was watching Finding Nemo that was the breakthrough for me about this, realizing that you could have this 12-step meeting for sharks and simply assume that everybody would understand what that was about. Now, it's not a very good 12-step meeting, so if you look at, but then there's lots of 12-step meetings that aren't that good anyway, but here were these sharks having a, we want to be friends with fish now, we don't eat fish anymore kind of meeting. And it was the assumption was even little kids would have some sensibility about what that was. That is a sign of a social movement that's made deep inroads into American culture. You can see this in language. 20 years ago, if you said you were an adult child of an alcoholic, no one would have known what you were talking about. No one would have a sense that that meant something, that it was a definable set of stuff that a person might have. Today, just about anybody, if you say you're an adult child of an alcoholic, they'll say, oh, I recognize that. I don't know much about it, maybe, but I know that's something to be. Okay? That's a huge change in our culture, a huge change in awareness of stuff. So I think it deserves to be construed to be a distinct culture, and I suppose the other mark of a distinct culture might be that people who are not part of recovery culture think of it as those people. It's not just us, it's those people, and people in recovery culture often find have a hard time navigating their way in non-recovery culture as well. So, now, I'm going to assume that you all have some grasp on Christian culture, what that's about, since it's a Christian recovery conference, and you have a sense of the fact that cultures are not monolithic, and since you know Christian culture best, you probably have a deep sense of what that means. Christian culture is not monolithic. It's not out of the same mold. We're all over the charts, you know. People who have not participated in Christian culture don't know that. Just like any sort of missionary going to another culture, your initial impression is, well, this is all Thai culture, or this is all, you know, some other culture. And it takes a while before you realize this is really diverse. There's just all kinds of cultures here. And you sort of grapple with that complexity. People who are not part of Christian culture look at Christian culture and they're not aware of that texture and density. There are people, I have friends, who think that everything that Pat Robertson says is what all Christians believe. I find this horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. But if you don't know the culture, you don't know the diversity, you don't have a sense that of that complexity, how complex cultures are. Cultures are not monolithic. Therapeutic culture is not monolithic. You have everything from long-term psychoanalysis to short-term solution-focused therapy. You have people with very different instincts about the nature of the self and the nature of healing. Just a tremendous amount of diversity. They can't get along with each other, just like people in Christian culture can't get along with each other very, very well. Go to professional meetings in either of those cultures, and you find people always have more than enough things to argue about. The same is true of recovery culture. Very diverse. People do not always get along well with each other in recovery culture. And even people in recovery culture are sometimes surprised by this. And it leads to difficult situations in ministry. I remember, I guess I could tell that story. My wife and I were invited to teach at a Christian recovery conference in Cairo, Egypt, a few years ago. Large meeting, 300-400 people showed up for this. In addition to giving the plenary talks, they wanted me to meet with the leadership teams of all their ministries. And the leadership team that had been their historical strongest leadership team was their codependency groups. They'd always had a very strong CODA kind of presence in this church. And they were very proud of that. And so their public presentation of self was really proud of this. But this is where they were really concerned. They had a problem with their codependency groups. And I'll say this with a bit of an attitude so it's really obvious. The problem was, they used to be able to count on the codependency group leadership teams. Well, if they needed to have another group, they would always be available to do another group. And can you help us solve this problem? I think it's the easiest consulting gig I've ever had. Because you know, here they have this ministry that is working. You can tell it's working because people are acquiring boundaries and a capacity to say no and things like that. But it seems like a problem. This is because there's all kinds of diversity in recovery culture. And depending on what you're recovering from, you may or may not get along with people recovering from other kinds of things. Another example, I have a friend who's old-timer in AA who has this history now, despite the fact that I've called him several times, of speaking of 12-step groups for adult children of alcoholics as 12 steps for teddy bears. Very derisive tone in his voice. And so an outsider might look at recovery culture and think, well, everybody gets along, they're all on the same page. When you get in the culture, you realize there's lots of fault lines here. There's plenty to argue about. There's, we have all kinds of factions within recovery culture. We've got our 12-step Nazis. You know, we have very affectionate ties to the 12-step Nazi faction, or the Big Book thumpers. We have lots of different kinds of ways of doing the 12 steps. Actually, I want to talk about that again in just a minute, that kind of texture. But none of these cultures are monolithic, and they also have kind of a tribal subculture. Okay, you can certainly see this in Christian culture. Often we have tribes that develop quite unique language sets. We wind up kind of having to list harder to try to figure out what that means. You know, someone says something that seems like it's transparently obvious to them, and it's just not your language. You don't quite know what that means, and that's about the tribal complexity of different cultures, different values, beliefs, and traditions. And that's true of these other cultures as well. Recovery culture has a lot of diversity in its tribal structure. NA is not the same as AA. I mean, I have an old friend. I don't want to beat up on AA old timers this morning, but I just happened to have another friend who is not excited about NA using the 12 steps. He likes to say things like, you know, I don't want to be associated with junkies. We're respectable alcoholics. You know, which, you know, sounds completely nuts when you say it out loud, but I think that's kind of what's in his guts. I mean, you certainly don't want to be associated with sex addicts because, you know. So, you know, that's just people form cultures, and we tend to make the same mistakes over and over again because we're not quick learners, I guess. Next point I want to make about cultures in general is that living biculturally is really a challenge. It's any kind of bicultural living is hard. Talk to missionary kids. Talk to missionaries. You know, have one culture and they have another culture, and it's a lot of work to try to figure out where you are. Right? You can be very dislocating culturally. It's even a bigger challenge to try to live triculturally. My suspicion is that some of you, when I put those three circles on the screen, looked immediately at that center point and thought, wow, there's the sweet spot. I want to be right there where everybody will understand and appreciate me. I'm not saying this is necessarily diagnostic for codependency, but it is a troubling tendency, because at that sweet spot in the middle, you also have the potential for everybody not liking you, right? Because you're not doing it right. You're not doing our stuff right. Living triculturally is very dislocating. And sometimes we do that because it sort of matches our life experience. We don't have any choice about that. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. Let me say a few things about what I call rejectionist tribal cultures. In each of these three cultures, there's going to be a constituency that wants nothing to do with these other cultures. In therapeutic culture, it is not hard to find people who think that everything about Christian culture is about mass religious psychosis, right? Or opiate of the masses, right? It's just crazy, crazy, crazy. And it's not hard to find people in therapeutic culture who similarly think that recovery is just insane. After all, if you have a blown head gasket on your car, you wouldn't get together with other people who have blown head gaskets. You'd find an expert who knows how to fix head gaskets and ask the expert to fix your car. That's the sane thing to do. Okay? And this notion that people can get together and have work together from a position of weakness could be helpful to people, it just seems completely insane. Now, that's not everybody in therapeutic culture, but there's always going to be a constituency like that who won't have nothing to do with these other two. Similarly, in recovery culture, there's going to be people who think these other cultures are not going to be helpful to you. There's a long history of, at best, tolerance, if not out-and-out hostility towards therapeutic culture. People in AA often love to cite the letter from Carl Jung to Bill Wilson with reference to Roland H., a guy who was a client for with Carl Jung. And somehow within AA culture, it gets translated to be Jung saying, there's nothing I could do for this guy. He has to have a spiritual experience. It turns out not to be at all what Jung had to say. But it suggests a kind of hostility that's nurtured towards therapeutic culture. And there's all kinds of pieces there. I mean, both Matt and I are going to mention Freud this morning. What Freudian thing is behind that, I wonder. Freud, early in his career, published a study of cocaine as a cure for alcoholism. He found that if he gave his clients enough cocaine, they drank less. Now, this is one of the stupidest smart people in the history of Western civilization, as far as I'm concerned. It's probably true. He later sort of retracted that. But in the paper itself, he says that the biggest problem is we need a cheaper supply of cocaine. If we just had more readily available, cheaper cocaine, we could probably make significant inroads in the level of alcoholism. So that also shapes the kind of instinct in recovery towards therapeutic culture. The other obvious example of that is heroin. Heroin is not a natural product. It's a chemically modified form of morphine. It was first manufactured by Bayer Pharmaceuticals in Germany, and it was initially, for a short period of time at least, it was marketed as a cure for morphine addiction. Heroin was marketed as a cure for morphine. Now, morphine is just a delivery device. I mean, a heroin is a delivery device for morphine. As soon as it's in the body, it's metabolized into morphine. So it's like, look, we give this person this medication now, and they use less morphine. So I think that things like that, people coming up with cures that were not cures, had a shape on the beginnings of AA. I think that sort of hostility is still present there. And there's often a lot of hostility towards Christian culture. This is due to a lot of different things. People in Christian culture like to emphasize that AA's roots were in Christian culture, but people in recovery culture often emphasize we had to get out of that place to survive. Right? It's a little different reading on the same narrative. Now, if we'd stayed there, we would not be able to be who AA is. And I think there's a lot of truth to that side of the narrative. It suggests there's a lot of healing possible there because both of those narratives are very distorted. In Christian culture, again, it's not at all difficult to find people who want nothing to do with these other two cultures. They're the world. Why would you want to do, you know, that those cultures are about trusting the wisdom of men rather than trusting the truths of God's word. We don't want to have anything to do with that. You know, we're going to do something better than that. Okay? So there's going to be rejectionist factions in all these cultures. And my instincts, I do think I spent a good deal of time for quite a long time getting angry about this, and I decided this is probably just part of being human. There's going to be a bunch of people who find this a convenient resentment to nurture, and so they're going to do that. That's part of the deal, and I'm not thinking it's particularly a high priority to try to fix that. For our purposes, the interest is more what happens when you get closer to the boundaries between these cultures, right? What are the options? And let me just give some examples kind of on the axis between therapeutic culture and recovery culture. There's, of course, an entire treatment industry that has emerged at this boundary, right? There's a million plus people on any given day in treatment in the United States. I don't really know what that number is, other than it's more than a million. That's a whole bunch of people. And so there are enormous variety of treatment strategies, and if you're working in a treatment program, it's going to be dominantly, it's going to be profoundly affected by the realities of therapeutic culture. If you want to get insurance reimbursement, you're going to have to fulfill government obligations. Lots of constraints on what you can do and you can't do. This is not a bad thing. This is a social location. It's a pretty wonderful social location. But it is where it is. One of the things I'm probably going to say if I get anxious 10 or 15 times is I'm not about the business of finding the right social location for Christian recovery ministry. We need people in all these cultures, deeply embedded in all these cultures, who understand these issues. But it's important individually for us to know where we are, because that makes a difference. Working as a treatment provider is often a way to a bridge between therapeutic culture and recovery culture. Sometimes there's complications. There's going to be people in recovery culture who said, this is all about treatment. You know, the important thing is after treatment. In therapeutic culture, recovery culture is often regarded as aftercare. It's like, we're doing the important stuff in the treatment program, and that's just aftercare. We have a master's prepared social worker who takes care of all that. You know, we have our real heavy lifting people doing the treatment. I'm a big believer in treatment. And I think it gives people a lot of good head start in recovery. But people in recovery culture are going to be inclined to think, maybe you could have saved $40,000 and just did 90 meetings in 90 days. Right? You're going to get that feeling, right? You could have saved $40,000, just do 90 meetings in 90 days. Which I think will work for some people and not for others. That's the rub, right? And so there's some there's nothing simple about that. And there's people in therapeutic culture, similarly, who are going to say, the heavy lifting is what you do in the program, not what you do after the program. So there's a diminishment of the other culture. A step closer to recovery culture is something like something fairly new, recovery coaching, which I think is going to take off big time in the next 15, 20 years, which is a kind of a new model. It's not the same as sponsorship, but it's having kind of individualized, personalized coaching. And, you know, again, there's going to be people in recovery culture who think this is like having a professional codependent, right? You know, going to be pretty hostile to this kind of strategy. And people in therapeutic culture who are going to think, therapeutic coaches are just saying, well, you're not well trained, because most recovery coaches are going to be people coming out of recovery culture, had the personal experience of recovery, got 10, 15 years of sobriety, and so that's not enough to get you any cred in therapeutic culture. They're going to retreat under pressure always to, well, where did you get your PhD? Closer to recovery culture, deeply embedded in recovery culture, is the role of sponsor. And that's kind of one of the unique, it's not unique, it's just a modern expression of spiritual director, which is something with a very deep history in the Christian tradition. So there's no novelty there historically, but in recovery culture, it's often treated as a novelty. Sort of, it must have been invented in the 1930s in Akron, Ohio, somehow. And I do think that over the years, AA in particular came up with a very novel way of doing sponsorship that sometimes is just spectacularly wonderful and helpful, and sometimes catastrophically bad, right? You've all probably had experiences like that, or known people who have had sponsors who were abusive, and so on. Now, on the axis between Christian culture and recovery culture, which is probably more pertinent to our considerations for this conference, there's also a kind of continuum of possibilities. And again, Dale's anxieties, there isn't any good place or bad place here. This is sort of, we need people doing all this kind of stuff. But let me use as an example of something that's sort of mostly, I think, within Christian culture, the Celebrate Recovery Ministry, which is a spectacularly successful and wonderful expression of recovery. And if you ask the people in charge, they'll be quite explicit about this is a Christian ministry. We're in Christian culture. We think, live, eat, drink, Christian culture. That's where we want to be. We want to be open and inviting people to come into Christian culture, but we're optimizing recovery for a Christian audience. Right? And problems with that? Probably every ministry strategy that anybody's ever thought of has a downside to it. It's got upsides and downsides. Embedding a Christian recovery ministry in the Christian community in this way has some huge advantages. There are probably lots of people who will go to a CR meeting who are not going to go to AA. And over time, a lot of these people, if you look at them and ask, well, what are they doing? You'll find that they're doing the stuff you do when you do the 12 steps. And in my book, that's what matters. They may have slightly different language for it. They may think it all comes out of the Beatitudes, which seems to me to be an enormous stretch. But that's small, picky stuff. That's really small, picky stuff. Right? Lots and lots of people able to maintain sobriety in their home culture, because it's more accessible, and going out there to a different culture to get help feels scary. Right? Something closer to the interface between Christian culture and recovery culture would be something like Overcomers Outreach. But there's a dozen or so networks like this out there. It's typically small, often regionally based, where their central metaphor is bridge. We want to be a bridge. And they're very self-consciously thinking about these two cultures, recovery culture and Christian culture, and asking, how can we make a connection? How can we have one foot in recovery culture and one foot in Christian culture? And usually, certainly if you go back to the founding of Overcomers Outreach, it was Bob Bartosz got sober in AA, but he was person of the church, and he would feel like he could go to AA and they got recovery, didn't have to explain that, but he always felt like he had to explain his Christian stuff. Nobody quite got that. He goes to Christian culture, everybody got the Christian stuff, didn't have to explain that, but he always had to explain recovery stuff. And it was just really nice to have one place where he didn't have to explain anything. It was just safe to be a Christian in recovery. Neither of those required explanations. And it was the sort of purpose is not so much like Celebrate Recovery, although there's overlap here, this is all fuzzy and big generalizations, but there's this sense that you want to help people from recovery culture make their way into Christian culture, and you want to make it easier for Christians to make their way into recovery culture. It's a different kind of instinct, different kind of way of doing business. A third thing, again, a big generalization here, since there's lots of varieties of this now, but there's a big difference between doing recovery stuff in a Christian context and doing Christian stuff in a recovery context. It's a different thing. And to sort of plant a church in recovery culture is a very different missiological adventure. Because like any missionary, you're thinking, well, how the way we say it back there in the culture we're familiar with might not work here. We might have to say this different. We might have to do things different. And what would that look like? Because we really want to make sure this gets embedded in this culture. And one of my favorite examples of this, we could use Mercy Street, where Matt and Greg have worked, or Teresa's Church, but I really like the experience of Joe Camp. Anybody know Joe here? Joe? Yeah, you know, blessings. Anyway, Joe was a pastor, I think it's UCC, United Church of Christ, in the Twin Cities area, Minneapolis, and he was, I love the way he tells his story. Took two churches from 500 to 2,500 to sequentially, so he really knew how to do church, very successful and young, enthusiastic preacher, and then he crashes and burns, ugliness ensues, but he gets really good help for himself. A few years later, he goes back to his bishop and says, I can't do that anymore. I'm not well enough to do that, whatever that was. I can't do that. What do you got? And the bishop says, well, there's this church in downtown St. Paul. It was right downtown, dying church. There wasn't any residential housing within 3.5 miles, so it didn't have any families walking to the church. And first time he preached, I think he said there were 11 people there. Five were his buddies from AA. The average age of everybody else was like over 65, and one of them, when he asked, well, what do you really want in a pastor? She said, I want to make sure someone's here to bury me when I die. So I was like, pretty dark. How can you really build a Christian community here? And so he's kind of grieving that, trying to figure out what to do that. Starts walking around his neighborhood while he's thinking that through, and realizes that there were 5 residential treatment centers for substance abuse within walking distance of the church. So he says, what would it look like to build a church just for the people who are where I am? And he does that. And, you got a kid in treatment, and the kid says, I went to church, and it was really helpful. You're going to visit that church. And so a lot of parents started coming, a lot of friends of, And all of a sudden you have a church built on a fundamentally different premise, in a different culture than the cultures he was accustomed to do church in. It was doing a Christian church in recovery culture, not doing Christian stuff. Not doing recovery stuff in a Christian culture. Now, does everybody need to do that? No. I'm going to assume you're smart enough to know that I get pretty stoked by that idea, but I really don't want to privilege any particular social location here. All these are really important tasks. We got addiction everywhere you look, so we need to be working all these angles, not just one. Okay, I want to talk more about the difference between Christian culture and recovery culture. I think I'll be preaching to the choir here mostly. I'm going to skip some slides about the difference between therapeutic culture and recovery culture. The big differences there are, there's a lot of common ground. Both therapeutic culture and recovery culture take personal pain seriously. They get the change, takes a long time. There's a lot of common ground there. The biggest differences have to do with accessibility. Therapeutic culture is expensive. I think I said last time I bought my therapist a small yacht, you know? But it's the best money I ever spent, you know? Best money I ever spent. But it means that there's an access issue. It gets hard to use medical model strategies in the slums of Manila. Okay, I tend to think globally about this. How do we come up with the Christian Church in America has tended to come up with strategies that don't translate very well outside of the middle classes. And recovery is one of the first things we've got, I think, that can go anywhere in the world. And AA has demonstrated capacity to thrive way outside of our cultural comfort zones. My wife and I went to talk at a conference in Mexico City some years ago, flew into Mexico City, got in a car, drove for 3.5 hours to what they called a town. The town was a crossroads of two dirt roads. On one corner was a store where you could buy warm soda or pop, wherever you're from. And on the other cross that intersection was a local AA meeting room with an AA symbol on the front door. I'm figuring if 3.5 miles out in Mexico City in the middle of nowhere, there's an AA meeting room. That's pretty good evidence that this stuff can translate pretty well. Okay, I'm going to skip some stuff about comparing therapeutic culture and recovery culture, and talk about comparing Christian culture and recovery culture. Because this is where most of the time most people doing recovery ministry are trying to navigate these two cultures. Right? And it either feels like, sometimes it feels like these are two cultures, both of which are hostile to your agenda. Church doesn't get it. Let's say you're very successful, you manage to establish a 12-step group, it's kind of marginalized in the congregation. If you ask people in the congregation about that group, they wouldn't be able to tell you whether that's something we're doing or that's something we let an outside group do. Right? Sort of kind of marginalized in that way. And recovery culture, you have all kinds of things. Of course, you have all kinds of people in recovery culture with just really deep and profound woundedness from spiritual abuse. Right? And so you can't sort of glibly speak about how great it is to be a Christian, because some of these people, just as have been many of us, pretty badly beat up in Christian culture. And so we can't afford to sort of skip over that. And when you're trying to do ministry, people don't necessarily know whether you're a safe person to be with because of those kinds of experiences. Where you see the big differences between a recovery culture and Christian culture in general is how we do small groups. People in Christian culture typically think, well, we've been doing small groups for a long time. We know all about how to lead small groups. We've had small groups since the 30s, so we don't need any training how to do another. It's just another kind of small group. This is an instinct that does not help anybody at all. Let me highlight some of the differences. The first It has to do with composition of small groups in the local church. I typically, well, I've run small group programs in churches before, and you want as many people to come as possible. You don't want to have any entrance fee for people to come in. You want everybody in the church to participate in the small group program, right? So you just have a wide open front door. We want everybody to be part of the small group because everybody needs to have fellowship. Whereas AA, or in recovery culture, tends to be very target population specific small groups. I myself think this is a pretty important piece of the puzzle. If you have a group for adult children of alcoholics, it's for adult children of alcoholics. If you have a group for AA group, it's for people with alcohol issues, right? And the reason that's important is that there's a confessional element to just showing up. There's no confessional element to showing up for a group to which everybody's invited, right? So there's no spiritual benefit for just going to a fellowship group. I mean, just showing up. There might be all kinds of good things that happen, but there's not that confessional element. And it's the same sort of confessional element, I think, that happens when you go to therapy. I told my therapist once I thought a third of the value of therapy was me just showing up, so I should get a discount of some kind, because I didn't go very far. So composition is very different. Leadership is profoundly different in recovery culture. The instincts about leaders. People in recovery culture are very suspicious of leadership. You don't want anybody showing up to do anything other than work on their own stuff. I have a friend who years ago we talked through developing a leadership training program for 12-step group leaders, and his view was, if you know how to read and you're working on your own stuff, you're qualified to lead a 12-step group. And I think he was right. I had very instincts mostly coming out of Christian culture, which valued creativity. You want highly trained leaders. You want leaders to know how to draw out people who are quiet, the version of crosstalk. You know, it's very different in instinct. And in recovery culture, lots of things are done to minimize the role of a leader. You use a script, typically in 12-step groups. Can you read? If you can read what's on this piece of paper, you can lead this script. And you rotate leadership. So the script says, hi, my name is blank. I'm the leader for this evening. And this is what we're talking about. Okay, those kind of things. Those are both ways to kind of minimize the significance of leadership. This is for a variety of reasons. One is ego, right? Hello. Self-willed one riot can show up in all kinds of groups, certainly in 12-step groups. And this is a structural way of putting some boundaries around it. The goals of typical small groups in the local church are very different from the goals of recovery groups. Usually a small group, it's where you make friends. It's for social networking. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, if you go to a small group in a local church and you're in an automobile accident, break your leg, you're in the hospital, those are the people who are going to show up. That's a wonderful thing for the church to be doing. But it's really different from what happens in 12-step groups. I'm not there to make friends, right? It's not my social network. A lot of social network might happen, but it's going to happen after the meeting, alongside the meeting, and other events, right? We're there to kind of report in about our 12-step work, not to sort of build friendships. The biggest differences have to do with different instincts when it comes to group process and what people actually do when they do group. Small groups tend to be discussion-centered processes with cognitive emphasis. So when I was training people to do small groups, it was teaching people how to ask questions like, well, what does someone else think? Does anybody else have an idea about this? Right? All frontal lobe language. And it's about discussion. I love discussion. Discussion is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful to have a bunch of people talking about and discussing things, but it's not what happens typically in 12-step group process, which is a narrative, sharing narratives, testimony kind of process, with an emphasis more on the affective than the cognitive. Right? And that creates a completely different group process. It's also true that typical small groups in a Christian community, confidentiality is not a big deal. It's not, you know, if you go to your core group or your cell group, whatever it is in your local church, and someone finds out that Mary is going into the hospital for an operation next Tuesday, and someone else in the group calls the prayer line so that everybody can be praying for Mary, everybody thinks they've done a good thing. They've been really helpful. In a 12-step group, if someone does the same behavior for the same reasons, it's experienced as a profound violation of group norms. You're no longer a safe person to be part of this group because you broke confidentiality, and I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to say the stuff I need to say if I had a sense that you might call the church prayer line. Just not going to happen. Okay, that's a huge cultural difference. That if people think that they already know how to do groups, so they should be easier for them to do how to do 12-step groups, you know, it's just a different thing. This friend I mentioned earlier who used to train churches to do 12-step programs used to say, I never had, when I was training pagans to do this was his language, when I was training pagans to do this kind of stuff, I never had to talk about confidentiality. I mentioned it once, they'd get it. But with Christians, you have to go over this and over this and over this, right? Because gossip is the social glue for most Christian churches. It's how we communicate with each other. In spite of the clarity of the biblical text about gossip, it tends to be how Christian communities operate. That's pretty staggeringly awful, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. There's also in small groups, I think, often an unarticulated assumption, particularly in discussion-oriented small groups, that you'll start with kind of easy, simple things. I went to a training program for small group leaders once where they said, start off with something like, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And then gradually kind of move towards more serious stuff. You're not going to start with, hi, my name's Dale and I'm a sex addict or something, right? You're going to start, you know, in 12-step culture, you start by saying the most difficult thing in life there could possibly be to say. The thing most encrusted with shame. That's what you say when you first open your mouth. That is the inexplicit testimony when you walk in the door. In discussion kind of support groups, it's maybe we can work a little bit in that direction, but my instinct is that any self-respecting addict could survive in discussion groups for a long time and would know how to just keep talking about their favorite flavor of ice cream, right? It's just another way of dancing from lily pad to lily pad and not telling the truth. Things like offering advice, drawing people out, clarifying things, all of that are the things that any good small group leader knows how to do. You want everybody to participate, don't you? But all those things are just crosstalk in 12-step culture. You know, you've been kind of quiet tonight. Would you like to share? It's like you get fired from your leadership position immediately, right? You may not be welcome back in the meeting. That's a really big cultural difference. And there's no shortage of people in the Christian community who have tried to start recovery ministries without getting those social differences down. It's not, again, it's another expression of Dale's anxiety. It's not that one's bad and one's good. It's one is located differently socially and has its own instincts and values that need to be respected. Finally, I think in small groups, what you get out of the group is what you get when you're at the group. You go to your core group or cell group and it's the experience of having gone that matters. And I think in recovery culture, there's much more of the sense that there certainly are people in recovery culture who think that the key to recovery is meeting makers make it, right? That it is about going to meetings that constitutes. And I'm a big fan of 90 meetings, 90 days, 180 and 180. It all makes sense to me. But I think there's also, certainly in California, I think the more common sensibility about this is that it's not so much going to meetings. Going to meetings is where you report in about the hard work you did outside of meeting. Because you got a sponsor, you're working the steps, and that's the heavy lifting stuff. That's where you get the work done. not so much going to meeting. There's actually some very interesting research in the last decade about this, which although it's very clear that there's a dramatic correlation between the number of meetings you attend attend during your first year of sobriety and whether or not you're sober, 18 years later, there was a recent study that looked at number of meetings attended in your first year and the likelihood of being sober 18 years later. It was stunning. Like, you more than double the odds of being sober in 18 years if you do more than 90 meetings in your first year. It's fascinating studies. But it's a correlation, right? It doesn't really tell you what it is that made the sobriety possible. It's something correlated with meeting attendance. But the more meetings you attend, the more likely it is that you'll have a sponsor, the more likely it is you'll be actually doing the spiritual practices that are the substance of the 12 steps, right? So the people who are inclined to do research about this don't really know yet what it is about being part of recovery culture that makes sobriety possible. But they're no longer arguing about whether it makes recovery possible. They're arguing about what is the specific thing there that's the most important piece about making recovery possible. And that's a big step in the right direction. There's a difference in spirituality between small group programs in the Christian community and recovery groups. Typically, cell groups, whatever you call them in your local church, they tend to have the same kind of spiritual sensibilities of the congregation as a whole. Often, pastors are very anxious about this, want to ensure that this is going to be true. Right? We don't want little cells of sedition of some kind or alternative views. We wouldn't want to have diversity in the church, you know. Whereas in recovery culture, there's an incredibly diverse range of spiritual sensibilities present. I think myself that one of the more significant factors there is the percentage of people in recovery who have experienced some kind of spiritual abuse. Okay? It's often one of the causes of addictions in the first place, and it certainly is one of the things that if you don't pay attention to, you'll wind up with a recovery culture that is insensitive to people struggling with those kinds of issues. And that results in a very different kind of sensitivity about spirituality. In recovery culture, in Christian culture anymore, I think particularly 21st century America, spirituality tends to be viewed as a kind of life enrichment activity, optional life enrichment activity. I have some extra time this summer. I'm either going to, learn how to scuba dive or take a spiritual class. I haven't decided. Recovery culture is not like that, right? Spirituality is not sort of an optional life enrichment thing. It's like it's the whole thing. It's life and death. It's the DNA of recovery. So it is treated far more seriously in many ways. But for a variety of reasons, tends to be treated with less need for everybody to be on the same page. I think that sort of being on the same page about spirituality is an illusion in most congregations, even congregations that are very explicit about what spirituality means. It means that we're just not going to talk about the stuff where we're not on the same page, right? So there's an illusion there that helps us keep thinking of ourselves as the people who have the right answers to the right questions. And there's no need for that kind of presentation of self in recovery culture. We just know that we're just another bozo on the bus. And that means that if we got something about spirituality wrong, it's just, hey, put it on the list. You know, put it on the list, because it's a long list. And it's not, it doesn't seem to be getting in the way of God being graceful. Right? I just feel inclined to preach for like a half an hour about nothing can get in the way of God being graceful. And that's a bit of wisdom that it's easier to kind of soak up in recovery culture, I think, that in Christian culture, where it tends to often feel like there's conditional clauses. I already talked about all things work together for good to those who love God enough. That's the conditional clause that we instinctively add, even though we don't say it out loud. If you're enough, then you get access to the love and grace of God. Nothing could be further from the truth for Christians. There is no shortage of the love and grace of God available to us today.